Dublin City Council has announced the final five proposed names for the new bridge over the River Liffey near Marlborough Street. The Council's Commemorative Naming Committee has reduced the previous shortlist of 10 names to five. And the five include former Dublin Camogie star Kay Mills, trade unionist and Easter Rising fighter Rosie Hackett, Alone founder Willie Birmingham, Legion of Mary founder Frank Duff, and Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. The five nominations will be put before a full meeting of Dublin City Council in the autumn for a final decision on the naming of the bridge. To help with their deliberations and to shed light on those involved, we're joined by a cast of thousands, really, to give their pitch for why their preferred candidate should be chosen. Well, perhaps not a cast of thousands, just five altogether. Three of them with me in the studio and two on the line. Representing Willie Birmingham, we're joined on the phone by his daughter, Kelly Birmingham. Emer Costello, MEP, joins us from Brussels to sing the praises of Rosie Hackett. With me in studio are Liz Howard, who will put the case for Camogie's Kay Mills. Fionnuala Kennedy is here to speak for the Legion of Mary, while Jimmy Bowler of Bram's Cafe in Fairview will support the creator of Dracula, Bram Stoker. What I'm going to do is ask each of you in turn to, uninterrupted, tell us about your candidate, and then we will go back to you and allow you again each in turn to state your case, and then we'll go back to you again and I'll just ask a few questions that occur in relation to the candidates. And we're going to do it in alphabetical order, so it's Birmingham, Duff, Hackett, Mills and Stoker. As I was saying, it sounds like a five-a-side football team. And therefore we will start with Willie Birmingham, and on the line is daughter of said Willie Birmingham, Kelly Birmingham. Kelly, just in a minute or so, give us the biographical, the basic biographical details of your father and what he achieved in his lifetime.
Well, good morning, Miles. Thanks very much, and you know what an honour it is to be in the list for Willie to be acknowledged in this way. He was an Inchicore man, born in Dublin 8. His father was a scrap merchant, and they cut turf on the mountains, supplied fuel to many of the people in the locality, which would have included Inchicore, Drimna, Ballyfermot, Bluebell, an extended area, and they eventually moved to Bluebell. He met and married my mother in 1972, but in between, in 1964, he joined Dublin Fire Brigade, and that, as you know, provides the emergency fire and ambulance service, and he would have been primarily focused on the ambulance because he had a gift of the gab, great at connecting with people. And through his work, he would have encountered an awful lot of vulnerable elderly people living in isolation, basically some of them in very squalid conditions. And I suppose some people would think that it's a housing issue, but actually that's a symptomatic problem of the loneliness and isolation that elderly people feel in their local communities when they become disconnected for whatever reason, whether it's a mental health issue or a physical issue, they become frail and infirm. And I suppose through that, he would have found an awful lot of people dead and isolated and maybe emaciated, you know, maybe left for months, weeks, it depends, you know, dead for days. And neighbours would have phoned up to say, can we get the fire brigade out here? There's a smell coming from the house. And they'd go in and find a dead body and maybe, you know, eaten by their pets or whatever, and quite often no electricity, no running water. And people are still being found in conditions similar to that. And I suppose the loneliness still exists today, and it is probably even more so today because communities have become so fragmented.
And that's what prompted him to found Alone.
It is. And, you know, he was coming home to my mother, Mary, and, you know, quite frustrated and given out about the conditions that he was finding people in. She just said to him, get off your backside and do something about it. So he went out and had photographs. He was very strong connections with Lima Cooney from, at the time he was with the Irish Press, a fantastic journalist. And he went out and took some photographs, and they put together a poster, went around the city, put them up in pubs, churches, community centres, wherever he could get space for them. And the campaign sort of began, and it was an accidental thing, really. He got a donation of 50 pence from a school child and a fiver from an old age pensioner, and just said, oh God, I'm going to have to go to and do something with this. So the calls started coming in, and at the time, being based in Tara Street, he was very central. He was in Tara Street Station there, just across from where the bridge is being built at the moment. And himself and his colleagues kind of just knocked heads together and said, look, this is what needs to be done. We're seeing it every day. And you know, as a Dublin Fire Brigade are out there 24/7 and encountering people who are very vulnerable. So they were instrumental in getting it off the ground, really, with him. And it was run from her home until he died in 1990, and it stayed there for maybe two or three years after his death, and then it was relocated down to Willie Berman Place in Kilmainham.
OK, we'll come back to you, and we will ask you why you think your father should have the bridge named after.
Thanks,
but
Miles.
Let me just move on to Frank Duff and Fionnuala Kennedy, author and economist, a UCD lecturer who wrote a book on the life of Frank Duff, joins us in studio. Tell us a little bit about Frank Duff. Again, stick to the biographical details, if you would.
Thank you, Miles. Well, Frank Duff was born in Phibsborough in 1889, and he lived all his life in Dublin, both north and south of the Liffey, until his death in 1980. He died in a house adjacent to the homeless hostels, which he founded in North Brunswick Street, the Morning Star and the Regina Chaley. He was a civil servant for 26 years. He worked first in the Land Commission, where he worked on the Wyndham Land Act, 1923. And then he was the first civil servant taken over by the new state. And he worked in the Department of Finance for 10 years. And he had a very interesting career there. He retired early in 1934 when he was in his 40s on a very tiny pension to devote himself entirely to his work in the Legion of Mary. But his work as a civil servant was very important. He came from a rising kind of middle class family. Both his parents had been civil servants. And he was really radicalised when he joined the Vincent de Paul Society exactly 100 years ago during the lockout. And he started visiting the tenements, and a world completely different to his world of two tennis clubs and middle class Dublin was revealed to him. And he became anxious to do something. He was somebody who really, when he saw a problem, he said, let's tackle it. And he did this with the homeless, with prostitution, with unmarried mothers. And really, the degree of his radicalism was quite remarkable, because at a time when the state and the official Catholic Church wouldn't really have had the scope or the desire maybe to support unmarried mothers, he said, it's appalling that women are being forced through economic necessity to give up their babies, either into orphanages and the women to go into the Magdalen homes. So he started a unit for mothers and babies where they could keep their children. And thousands of women over the years have gone through that system and continue to this day. Now, he was very empowering of women, and the very first group of legionaries, he claimed, in fact, that he wasn't the founder, that it was something that happened spontaneously, because at the time, Vincent de Paul was exclusively for men until, in fact, the 1970s. And some young girls who worked in Jacob's Biscuit Factory overheard a conversation about men visiting the wards in the South Dublin Union, which is now the wonderful St. James's Hospital, but then was the dreaded Union, and said, could we do that work? And that was actually what triggered the start of the Legion of Mary. They arranged a night, and they set it up for the following week. And now it's gone all over the world.
On an ongoing basis, briefly, what did the Legion of Mary then continue to do? What has it done in the meantime? So this organisation that he began, or, well, he may or may not have begun.
It has continued, Miles, to give effect to what he saw as practical Christianity, which was responsibility for one's fellow human being. He saw Christianity as something beyond mere socialism, that you had a duty, if you dared to call yourself a Christian, to be available to serve your neighbour in every form and your environment, so that he was very interested in what he described as practical patriotism. And all around the world, the genius of the Legion of Mary is that it has stayed out of any form of political activism. It has drawn on membership from all backgrounds. For instance, to give you an example, in Syria at the moment, there's a very active Legion group in Aleppo. And in the last few weeks, contact was made with them. And they said, oh, we're working away. We're going ahead with the work. They're all works of personal service. And that is what the emphasis is. And right. The inspiration is what he would see as real Christianity.
OK, so there's an international dimension to Frank Duff in addition to the domestic
4 million
dimension.
Members worldwide.
OK, that's pretty international. Largest,
the largest, as the Irish Times said, the largest international organisation to emanate from Ireland.
Right, we'll move on then from Frank Duff to Rosie Hackett and Emer Costello, Labour MEP. Emer, good morning to you.
Good morning, Miles.
Right, tell us a little bit about Rosie Hackett and who she was.
Well, Rosie Hackett is one of the unsung heroes or heroines, but a remarkable woman all the same of the 1913 lockout and indeed the struggle for Irish independence. She was born in 1892, and indeed she has a lot of links with the local area close to Marlborough Street. She grew up in a tenement building in Old Abbey Street, and she would remain for most of her life connected to the Marlborough Street area and around Liberty Hall. She got her first job in Jacob's factory at the tender age of 17, and the conditions there were really quite appalling for the workers. Larkin actually said that the biscuit makers would be sent from this earth 20 years before their time. Conditions were so bad. And Rosie immediately became an activist. She joined the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, and from all accounts she was very she was quite the activist in Jacob's on behalf of the workers involved in industrial action in 1911 and again then in 1913. When she joined Jacobs, she was one of the people who was instrumental in establishing the Irish Women Workers Union, which again had its headquarters in Liberty Hall. She played a remarkable part in the 1913 lockout. She was on O'Connell Street for the Bloody Sunday protests, and indeed she took a stance and was locked out of her own job in Jacobs. Throughout the lockout then, as people who have read Strumpet City will be aware, hunger and poverty were just absolutely widespread. And Rosie was one of those who worked to help the strikers. She set up the soup kitchens in Liberty Hall, and she ensured that as many of the children were fed during that period. And then after the lockout, like many of the other workers of the period, she lost her job in Jacobs for her role in the lockout. She was fortunate that she got a job as a clerk in the Irish Women Workers Union, again in Liberty Hall, and she worked alongside people like Delia Larkin and Helena Maloney. And then she became connected with the independence struggle. She became connected with the Irish Citizen Army, and she trained as a printer at the time as well. Indeed, she was present when the original proclamation was printed and presented to James Connolly. She joined the Citizens' Army. She fought with Countess Markovic at the College of Surgeons. She was arrested for her part in that, and she was sent down to Kilmainham Jail. And then when she was released again, when she came out of prison, she realised that the Irish Women Workers Union needed to be revived. And along with people like Louis Bennett and Helen Shenevix, she revived the Irish Women Workers Union. She was involved in it for a lifetime, and under their leadership, the Irish Women Workers Union made huge inroads into women workers' rights. It was the laundry workers' strike in 1948 that actually secured the right to 2 weeks paid holidays for all workers. So Rosie continued to serve with the trade union movement until her death in 1976. She was aged 84. She spent 40 years actually working down in Eden Quay on the Eden Quay Cooperative, and again I think this underlines her connection with the area. So Rosie is she's a working class heroine. She's a local heroine, and I think she's somebody who's deserving.
Right. Okay. Well, we come back to you, and you can put the case for her in just a little while. That's Emer Costello on Rosie Hackett, and our next candidate is also female, Kay Mills, the Dublin Camogie player, and Liz Howard, herself a GAO stalwart, first ever female analyst on the Sunday Game. Tell us a little bit about Kay Mills.
Good morning, everybody. Kay was a real Dublin person. She was born in Inchicore and she lived most of her life in Abercorn Terrace. Her mother was from Dublin and her dad was from Cork. Her mother died when she was 18 months old, and she was raised by her father and her grandmother. She was one of a family of four, And at a very young age, she showed huge sporting prowess. She was a very good athlete. She was very good at gymnastics and also table tennis, but she excelled at camogie. And she was a member of the Great Southern and Western Railway Club, where her father was a member because he worked on the railways. And that was later the CIE Club, where all sports were catered for. She left school at a very young age and she worked in Lamb's factory, and she saw what was happening there, I suppose, very much like Rosie Hackett. And later on, she used those skills when she and her husband went into business. They opened a leather manufacturing business, first of all in Phibsborough and later in Hill Street. They employed a number of people, up to 50 people, and they were very good and kind and fair employers because she had seen the inequality as well. She upskilled herself. She was a very intelligent woman, even though she left school very young. She upskilled herself. She did everything from the cutting, the sewing, the sales, the marketing, the recruiting and the training of her staff there. But her great achievements as well were on the camogie field. At a very young age, she was chosen to play for Dublin Camogie. And at that stage, camogie was the only female national game for women.
She was about 14 years old.
She was a little bit older, I think. I think that might have been a bit of a myth that she was 14, because when I was doing the sums, I think she was a little bit older. But she, Dublin Camogie was very strong, but camogie was played all over the country at that stage.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking about she made her first appearance in 1940, and she won her first All-Ireland in 1941. She went on to win 15 senior All-Ireland medals, and that is a record in team sports in Gaelic games. If you look at Christy Ring, Henry Shefflin, John Doyle, they have 9, and that's huge, but they trail in the wake of Kay Mills. She lined out at midfield in every game that she played for Dublin at midfield. She was never substituted. She had immense skill. I never saw her playing, but people like Micheál Murathaigh said she had skill, she had class. She was a tremendous athlete, and she had a great camogie brain, or hurling brain, whichever you like to say. In addition to her 15 All-Irelands, she also won 20 Leinster championships, 6 Dublin County championships, 5 interprovincial medals. And she was the first woman in Gaelic sports who was the sports star of the week in the Irish Independent. And that was huge at the time. Just consider, it was very much male-dominated. In 2004, the centenary year of camogie, she was an automatic choice on the team of the century. She was also inducted into Chulainn Hall of Fame. And her entire medal collection is on show in the museum, in the GAA Museum in Croke Park.
It takes up a lot of space.
And it's fantastic. And I was there recently, and so many kids, and not so many kids, and adults as well. She was a wonderful ambassador for camogie and a great role model for all aspiring young players. She retired at the top of her game, and the cup that's awarded to the All-Ireland Premier Junior Championship is named in her honour. She was very involved in her community as well in Inchicore. She's a great love of Dublin and a great knowledge of Dublin. And a couple of years ago, a plaque was unveiled at Abercorn Terrace, where she grew up and lived. And that was a joint initiative between the Camogie Association, the Inchicore Kilmainham Heritage Committee and Dublin City Council.
Right. Liz, thank you very much indeed for telling us about Kay Mills. Somebody has texted in to say, 2 from Inchicore, Kay Mills and Willie Birmingham, something in the Dublin 8 water. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Right, our fifth and final candidate, final only because of alphabetical order, and that is Bram Stoker. And here to advocate the cause of Bram Stoker is Jimmy Bowler, the owner of Bram's Cafe in Fairview. A little bit, first off, Jimmy, purely and simply, biographical detail. Who was Bram Stoker?
Well, Bram Stoker was born in the Crescent in Fairview. I think everybody knows a bit about the Dracula bit. He was educated in Trinity College. He was a noted athlete, gymnastics, rugby. He went to work in the civil servant, as a civil servant. He worked in the as a theatre critic, newspaper editor, barrister. He moved to England then, and he was working for Henry Irvine in the Lyceum Theatre. Listening to the other speakers there about, you know, their the biographies of the other people mentioned here and their struggles and all that, I think I'm coming at this from a totally different side. And it's mostly to do with his legacy. His legacy is his literary contribution, and it's unmarked in our own city.
Okay, well, we'll come to that a little bit later.
Going back to that, just returning to that, he's also the author of 12 other novels, a series of short stories, and non-fiction, and a whole load of other stuff like that. His early life was spent in around the Dublin city in Trinity College.
But aside altogether from his writing, he's also well known as a theatre manager. He'd be very well known in London, for example.
Yeah, he was the first to bring in pre-booking tickets. He was the forerunner of the Ticketmaster, and he successfully turned around.
I'm not sure if there's too many people thank him for that.
But he was able to fill the theatre at times. Because that theatre was struggling at the time that he moved over there, and he created the demand. And again, using the psychology that this place had, you need to see this play, and the tickets weren't available, so you need to book them in advance. And he was using stuff like that to
a very good publicist.
As I say, his early career certainly wouldn't be as anything like the previous candidates for this. I think what Stoker has given us is a legacy.
Yeah.
And that legacy is his writing, particularly built around the Brahms, Dracula product.
We'll come back to that. That's the advocacy part, which we were coming to. We're going to come to now. And we will start that back to Willie Birmingham and to his daughter, Kelly Birmingham. And a very simple question, Kelly, why should the bridge be named after Willie Birmingham, your father?
And mobilised so many people in terms of volunteering and active citizenship and connecting with the elderly and vulnerable people in the community. And, you know, all the people who would have been instrumental over the years as volunteers of Alone, starting with the Dublin Fire Brigade, on post personnel were absolutely fantastic, because they were the ones knocking on the doors, dropping in parcels or letters or whatever, or even bills. And they'd notice and call us if somebody was in a bad way. Media personnel who, you know, obviously they were instrumental in getting Willie's message across to highlight the plight of loneliness. And Alone stood for and stands for A Little Offering Never Ends. And that offering was not financial to salve your conscience in terms of how people were isolated. It was to actually get up and go and make contact with people, offer your time, which was invaluable. And that is still ongoing. You know, that people say to me on a regular basis, oh my God, your dad's Willie Birmingham. And, you know, we lived the experience. It was run from our house. We had people, it was as busy as O'Connell Street. We had people coming day and night donating clothes, fuel, you know, and particularly in the winters of 1982, and it was an exceptional year when people's roofs were falling in on them with the weight of snow on top of them, and people were coming out in the middle of the night, seeing what they could do, how they could assist. And that was really what it was about, and continues to be about. Internationally, he was recognised as International Firefighter of the Year, and that was something that no other firefighter in Ireland has ever achieved. But he took that on behalf of all the firemen who he, you know, represents as he saw it. I just think it would be tremendous. And the fact that he was stationed at Tower Street, which is just adjacent there, he worked both sides of the city, dealt with people of all creed, culture, you know.
So there's a local element to it as well, even though, as you said, he's from Inchicore, he was associated with Tower Street.
So proud to be a Dubliner. And when he was acknowledged by Trinity College with an honorary doctorate of law, that to him was just unbelievable. And in his interview, his final interview with Colm Connolly, he was asked, you know, what would you like to be remembered for? And he said, well, you know, shoveling feces was one of the, not how he said it, but, you know, that's what he did. But his ambition was to
see
Alone go out of business.
There's an assonance, I presume, there, yes.
You know, he was a practical, hands-on man, and he wanted to see Alone go out of business, because he thought, well, you know, people need to take responsibility for their own communities and inspire that in others. And he wanted to see that continue, you know, that people would take that on board.
OK, I'm going to come back later and I'm going to ask you some fairly specific questions,
sure.
But just to move on then to Frank Duff and Fionnuala Kennedy, why should this bridge be named after Frank Duff?
Duff was a Dubliner, but he's also an international figure. The Legion of Mary is in virtually every country in the world. He is probably much better known outside of Ireland. For example, there are 200,000 legionaries in South Korea, 250,000 in Brazil, 1 million in Africa. And it's very hard to think of anybody else who has projected Dublin and Ireland in the way that Frank Duff has. He's also a unifying figure. He was an early pioneer of ecumenism. He set up meetings with the Jews in Dublin during the Second World War, which is really hard to credit now, but he established the Pillar of Fire Society, the Mercier Society with the other Christian religions. He was always developing new projects, and the ideas weren't always his, but if he heard of a good idea, as, for example, there was a young doctor working in a village in the south of Ireland, and in the 1950s, it was in a very poor condition. And he organised a team of legionaries to go down and literally sweep the streets and paint the shop fronts. And this started a work in the Legion called True Devotion to the Nation, because he felt that everybody was capable of giving something to the community. And there isn't in the 4 million members a single paid employee. It's a truly voluntary organisation. And I think that's something also at a time, I suppose this is the economist coming out in me, where we are very short of cash, that there are so many things that people can do to help other people on a voluntary basis. And the Legion provides an exceptional organisation really to do this. And in a very unifying way, that he bridges class, gender, race.
That's very subtle, by the way, getting the word bridges into
I didn't even notice it.
There you go.
I could say that on my book, it's quite strange, and it was an English publisher and an English cover designer. The River Liffey actually features on the cover of the book.
Right. Okay. We will thank you very much for that piece of advocacy, and we will move on then to Rosie Hackett and back to Brussels and to Eimear Costello, the Labour MEP. Eimear, just state your case as to why this bridge should be called after Rosie Hackett.
Well, thanks, Miles. I think that we're now entering into a decade of national commemorations. We're celebrating this weekend the actual centenary of the 1913 lockout, and that'll lead up to the commemorations for the 1916 Rising, the War of Independence, the Civil War. And I think Dublin City Council has a unique opportunity to recognise a champion of this period with the naming of the bridge. And I think that it would be timely that it would be a local hero, a local girl, Rosie Hackett, who championed women's rights, workers' rights, Irish independence. But I think another reason too why Rosie would be important is that it provides a very timely opportunity to commemorate the role that women played in our city's history. It's really, I think, to our shame that not one bridge, there's 16 bridges over the Liffey, not one bridge, not one train station, not one significant monument in our city is dedicated to the memory of a woman. And I think women are being written out of very pivotal events of both the social and national struggles of the early 20th century. So I think for that reason, Rosie is an ideal candidate for the job.
Right. And sorry, just very briefly, just to wrap up on that one.
Yeah, and just to say then, I think that it would be an acknowledgement of the struggle of workers. She's an ordinary person, in many ways, you know, unremarkable, but had a remarkable life and made a real contribution to the city and has an intrinsic link to the area, growing up in Abbey Street, working in Liberty Hall, spending all her life up and down Eden Quay, and no doubt up and down Marlborough Street as well. I think that she is the ideal person for the name of this bridge.
Right. Moving on then, moving back to Liz Howard. And why should Kay Mills have the bridge called after her?
Well, I think it was interesting listening to Eimear there. The Camogie Association was founded in 2004, and it grew out of, I suppose, the time when the civil service was open to women. And Camogie, the foundation of Camogie, and the, I suppose, evolution of women are very much linked. But if you look at Dublin, it's a city of great sporting diversity. There's a great passion for sport and an avid interest in sport right across the spectrum. You know, sport lifts the spirits. It's a healthy pastime. It provides entertainment. It contributes to the economy of the city. It provides fun. And it also gives a sense of connection that very few other aspects of Irish life do so successfully. Jack Lynch is the Cork has the Jack Lynch Tunnel and the Christie Ring Bridge. So it's an ideal opportunity for Dublin City Council to honour Dublin star Kay Mills. She remains, I suppose, Dublin's most famous sportswoman, and it's unlikely that her achievements will ever be equalled. She linked in with the transport industry as well, with her being a member of the CEIE Club. And the new bridge, of course, will facilitate transport. To quote Micheál Mórchuid Hirsig, she grew up and lived all her life within a puck of a schlitter from the majestic River Liffey. Dublin City Council has the opportunity to name a new bridge in memory of a revered Dublin sportswoman and a first woman as well. The choice of Kay Mills would be greeted favourably right across the city. We have the backing of the GAA at national Dublin level, the Camogie Association, ladies football and a number of different communities across Dublin. Kay Mills reaches a wide community. There is no controversy about her. She's a fantastic person. I suppose if I say Kay Mills, Laker Gael Sportul Oclia, on an Orthaw Tilta Gamati, a Hanama Hort on Drihad Nua, Drihad Kay Mills.
Okay, Liz, thank you very much indeed. And finally, back to Jimmy and Bram Stoker. You were talking about the legacy of Bram Stoker. Presumably that's the case that you would make as to why the bridge should be called after him.
Well, Dublin is one of six cities in the world that has been designated a UNESCO City of Literature. Dublin is a tourist city, and we should always work to accentuate the positive. We have literary positives scattered throughout Dublin. The pattern has already been set for naming bridges over the Liffey. We have the Sean O'Casey Bridge and the Samuel Becker Bridge. And it is my contention that it should be the Bram Stoker Bridge in 2014. Literature is a unifying force. And look at the works of Seamus Heaney and Brian Friel, for example. So why Bram Stoker? If literature was a branding game, Bram created one of the greatest brands of all times. There is over 700 movies, video games and whatever associated with Bram Stoker. There's 1,000 comic books with the mention of Dracula in it.
I'm just running out of time here and I want to just a couple of specific questions to everybody. So let me start with you. You've made the point about bridges being called after writers. Is that not a disincentive to call the bridge after Bram Stoker? Don't we already have enough bridges named after writers?
I think if we're going to build on this, the Dublin as the UNESCO City of Literature, it is continuing that. It's branding the Dublin as the city. And what greater way to brand it is to continue that with our literary giants like the likes of Bram Stoker.
But is he also somebody who's not more associated perhaps with London than he is with Dublin?
I wouldn't think so. That's our fault. You know, one could really argue. I mean, it is a great shame that he is not as well known in Dublin. In the last couple of years since we started on this project, he is better known. We've had great events last year on the centenary of his death. Again, this year we have the Bram Stoker Festival coming up in the October bank holiday weekend. And it's hoped to build that to almost as good as St. Patrick's over the next 10 years. Dublin City Council are very enthusiastic about building that project.
Just to move back to Kay Mills, Liz, some people have said that Liz Howard would actually be a better candidate for having the bridge named after her than Kay Mills, that she's better known than Kay Mills.
But no, that's a total myth. Kay Mills is famous. I just happen to be a bit well known in certain circles. There's a world of difference between famous.
Why, though, a sports person rather than somebody who, for example, like Willie Birmingham, saw a huge social problem, or Frank Duff saw huge social problems and tackled them?
Yes, and I recognise that and recognise the contribution of all the people who are on the final list. But I think, you know, we can look at sport in a different way. It brings so much to all our lives. And if you look every Sunday in the play, every, I suppose, weekend during the playing season, whether it be to the Aviva Stadium here in Croke Park, so many people cross the many bridges of along the Liffey, the lovely, wonderful Liffey. And these people will go to Croke Park next Sunday to support Kerry and Dublin. It wouldn't be lovely if next year they could cross a bridge called Kay Mills Bridge.
Okay, and back to Emer Costello in Brussels and Rosie Hackett. Is there not already sufficient recognition, Emer, of the labour movement in Dublin? You've got statues, for example, to Larkin in O'Connell Street and to Connolly beside Liberty Hall. Is that not enough?
Well, I think that the unique selling point on Rosie as well is that Rosie represents working class women. And I think that, as I said, women have been very much written out of Dublin's history. There is no monument to a woman. 16 bridges, not one of them called after a woman. And I think calling the bridge after Rosie would be a very fitting recognition of the very unrecognised contribution working class women made to the history of modern Ireland.
And moving with that on that one, that specific issue, Fionnuala, in relation to Frank Duff, why not call the bridge? Is it not time to call the bridge after a woman?
Well, Miles, I've just never been a quota person myself about women. I think that I have great respect for the women who are nominated, and indeed I could think of other women. I mean, just recently during the horse show, there was an exhibition about Iris Kellett, and she brought extraordinary fame to Ireland as a sportswoman. And she was a very low-key, modest woman, and I think there should be something named after her.
Just specifically, because we're running out of time again, in relation to Frank Duff, we already have the Matt Talbot Bridge.
Yes.
And I think in the minds of a lot of people, Frank Duff and Matt Talbot would be seen to represent the same kind of thing. So do we need a bridge called after Frank Duff?
I think Frank Duff's contribution was quite extraordinary. And I think that when you look at the problems that arose in relation to institutions and the way children were treated, I think somebody who was so countercultural and so radical at the time and looking to provide practical service for the most vulnerable, I think it would be a tremendous statement to make that we want to salute the work of this man who worked for women and children and gave tremendous roles in the organisation. The first president of the Legion was a woman, an office cleaner, Elizabeth Kerwin. Edel Quinn went to Africa as a young girl and worked there tirelessly, travelled tremendous distances, serving the people there.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're really running out of time, and I briefly want to get back to Kelly Birmingham. Kelly, that issue about the bridge being called after a woman, assuming obviously you want it called after your father, but do you not think that there is a huge case to be made that it should be called after a woman?
Well, I think there's a case for anybody on the merits of their work. I think it trivialises any decision if you reduce it to a gender debate. I don't think this is about gender. I think this is about achievements being acknowledged. Whoever it is decided, we're honoured and delighted that Willie's in the top five. But whoever gets it, it should be on the merits of their work, their achievements, the impact that they have, the people that they've potentially impacted through their and inspired to do better things in their lives, whether it's a sporting achievement, a literary achievement, or indeed a volunteering achievement. It doesn't matter what it comes down to. It should be on the merits of the work, not gender.
Okay, thank you.
I'd be very
all
clear about that. In fact, I actually had a statement from one of the city councillors saying that it would be down to gender from his perspective, and not just him, a couple of others as well. But I was quite taken aback by that because I thought we were gone beyond that in this day and age.
Okay, thank you all very much indeed. Kelly Birmingham, Emer Costello, Liz Howard, Fionnuala Kennedy and Jimmy Bowler. I'm not sure if any of the arguments we've heard will sway the decision of the city fathers, or even if they've been listening. If they haven't been listening, they can podcast the item. And I will leave you with a comment from Arthur Brady, who says a lot of people will be unhappy with whatever name is chosen. So why not call it the Bridge? Because somebody will take umbrage. That's Arthur Brady's responsibility. We'll take a break.